It's been 1 year since the fall of Afghanistan's government and the return of power to the Taliban. The lightning advance on Kabul prompted scenes of chaos at the airport as people tried to flee. Over 120,000 were airlifted out of the country in the days that followed. In the years since, the United Nations has warned that the combination of conflict, pandemic, drought and restriction of foreign aid has left 23 million people at risk of hunger and starvation. And as feared, the Taliban's restrictions on women were quickly reinstated, including a ban on girls being able to go to secondary school. One person determined not to let the world forget is BBC journalist Yelda Hakim, who puts out a daily tweet with the number of days since teenage girls were allowed in the classroom. Her foundation, set up in 2018 to help get young Afghans into higher education, helped evacuate over 200 students and other at-risk people from the country. And Yelda has just returned from Kabul and is with us. Welcome. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Catherine, for having me.
What sense were you able to get from your latest trip to Afghanistan about what life is like for those living again under Taliban rule?
Well, Catherine, I think in many ways, when I was there straight after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban in November and December of last year, there was a sense of shock and uncertainty. People weren't sure which direction the country would go in and what it would mean for them, especially the women and girls of the country. They thought perhaps the Taliban have just come back to power, they're adjusting, the world is adjusting, and there was almost a sense of hope, I think, that the fighting had ended and perhaps the Taliban themselves had learned lessons from the past. Well, we're now a year into the Taliban rule. And as you say, I put out a daily count. Today marks 331 days since the Taliban banned teenage girls from going to school. And we have to remember that all boys across the country are allowed to go to school. Girls under the age of 12 are allowed to go to school. But girls over the age of 12 and beyond are not allowed to go to school. And I have put it to Taliban leaders, did you fight for 20 years? Was this war so that you could take on teenage girls, 12-year-old girls, and their desires and dreams to be educated and to have a future? Is this what it was all about for you? And they say, no, we will eventually get them back to school and it's a cultural issue or it's a religious issue. But frankly, Afghan families are increasingly frustrated. We're now 12 months into their rule, and it feels as though very little is going to change.
We saw shots fired at a protest. I was seeing on my TV screen just yesterday. Shots fired at a protest about those who do resist. But come back to questions you've put to the Taliban. In the end of the occupation, if you like, the presence of the United States and allies and this chaotic exit followed, and also the Taliban's very, very rapid overrunning of Kabul. They had a PR machine running. They had a very slick PR machine running, telling a different story, it appears, to what has unfolded, Yelda. Why is there such a difference between what they talked about and what has happened?
I think So the one thing that they realized over the last 20 years is the use of social media and the use of messaging and the use of a campaign where they are speaking a language that the media can sort of take and tolerate, the international community finds palatable. And so they've used this rhetoric where they talk about the importance of girls' education. They talk about the importance of women being able to participate in public life and the fact that is what Islam prescribes. So of course we would offer that. But, you know, recently when there was just so much despair about these young girls not going to school and then the leader of Al-Qaeda being found in Kabul, a friend of mine said to me, why are you so confused about this? Why did you think that they would be any different? They are ideologues. You can't be half communist. They have a certain set of beliefs and they are not going to suddenly change overnight. They believe certain things and that is what they're trying to implement. And they have a base to appease. They have these fighters, these men who have fought for 20 years and they have been fed certain things. They're not going to suddenly shift and change that overnight. In fact, they may never do. And so I think ultimately, though, it's very difficult for an Afghan family, an Afghan woman, an Afghan mother to see her daughter and her dreams be crumbled and crushed. Many of these women and mothers were teenagers under the first Taliban rule. They never, ever anticipated that their own daughters would be going to secret schools today. We heard about secret schools in the 90s. Never in our wildest dreams did we think that in 2022, secret schools would pop up all over the country and young girls and women and mothers would have to find alternative methods for their daughters to learn.
What else is happening? Because, of course, we are now hearing, you know, real fears of terrifying numbers of people at risk of starvation. What is happening also with the transition from the Taliban from a rural insurgency to now running a country, and how well is the country running under their rule?
And I think that is what we I think are witnessing, that they are a sort of a fractured group of militia who don't, they're not a sort of, monolithic group. They don't speak with one voice. There's multiple Taliban. There's the Taliban known as the Kandahari Taliban. There's the Haqqani Taliban. There's so many different elements and leaders and voices. And they themselves are struggling to kind of bring it all together and speak under the one umbrella. So they sort of defer to the emir to make certain decisions and dialogue. And they had this sort of grand shura of over 3,000, almost 4,000 men come together in Kabul to talk about the issues that they were facing and almost to celebrate their victory. But the truth is that when we hear the UN say that this is a march towards starvation, that this is a march towards catastrophe, that is what we're seeing. Poverty and malnutrition and famine is not new to Afghanistan. But what is new is that it has suddenly, it is now at full speed, that malnutrition was almost seasonal in the country. And so in certain times in the year, doctors would see more admissions, or there would be certain children that would die in certain villages because they couldn't get out of the villages because of the fighting. Now they can. So there's a surge. There's also a freezing of assets. The international community, the Taliban is seen as a pariah state, so they're not willing to recognize or engage with them. All of these things combined have caused what I describe as three crises. The first, the humanitarian crisis, where we're seeing literally people dying and starving. The second is a security crisis, where the Taliban are struggling to maintain security, and we're still seeing bombs go off across the country. And the third, we're seeing a human rights crisis. And that really is related to, you know, people's lives being monitored by this group, especially women and children.
The question is, Yelda, now what will happen and what ought to happen with respect perhaps to the international community's responsibilities, because it was a 20-year war. The US was determined to leave. It did leave. And now, a year on, there are consequences of that decision. But what should the rest of the world be doing about what is unfolding?
I think it's exactly what you said. The international community went into that country, and they may, whatever they may say now, that we weren't there for nation building, we were there for homeland security, we were there to keep the rest of the world safe, we were there because we wanted to ensure that Al-Qaeda wouldn't thrive. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we found the leader of Al-Qaeda killed in a drone strike by the United States. Less, even a year hadn't passed at that point when the Taliban had swept to power. So that in itself, tells you everything about the situation right now that's unfolding before our very eyes. And we hear these intelligence reports where, the US intelligence community comes out and says, we have concerns about Al-Qaeda taking a foothold and other terror organizations within Afghanistan. This is now the reality of the country. And so, but beyond that, I think when we talk about commitments and values and standing and believing in certain things, well, is it that nations invade a country, and then when they decide to go, they completely sort of cut ties with that nation and the promises that they had made to the population. I met women in Herat on my recent trip who brought me sort of boxes and boxes of certificates of recognition from Brussels, from Paris, from Washington, from London, from traveling all over Asia, going to conferences, the promises of human rights, democracy, freedom, women's rights. These are things that these people had been fed for 20 years, and it wasn't a perfect situation. There were many issues across the country, and there were very, very difficult and challenging times over the last two decades. But now what I constantly hear, especially from the women of the country, is abandonment and betrayal.
We've only touched on what they're going through, Yelda. We've talked about the inability to go to school and having to, go to secret schools. But just what is happening? What is the oppression that happens, particularly to anyone who resists?
Well, as you say, yesterday, women were out on the streets again, bravely protesting. I have to say, when I was there, it's incredibly intimidating to see young men walking around with loaded guns across the city. It's frightening. And these women live in that reality, and they stare down the barrel of a gun, unsure of what the person that they're looking at and the gun that they're looking at is going to do next and what is going to happen next. But they tell me that many of these women I've spoken to, and I spoke to some of the protesters who were out there yesterday, I say to them, why do you do it? Aren't you afraid? And they say, we have nothing to lose now. We have lost our freedom. We have lost our sense of identity and purpose in life. And we feel very much like the international community and the whole world is not listening and doesn't care. And we're here on our own. So we have to fight this fight for ourselves. And I think that steely determination, really is awe-inspiring, but also quite frightening. How long? I met young women, and I haven't been able to. I've got a documentary that's running this weekend about a policewoman who's disappeared, and her family don't know where she's gone, and they point the finger of the blame on the Taliban. But I spoke to several other women who had spent time in Taliban prisons, and they told me that they had been tortured by the Taliban, and they had been mistreated simply for protesting, simply for demanding their basic human rights. But I couldn't run those interviews. I still have them, and I'm not able to run them because the women said to me, we will soon be leaving this country. And 3 or 4 weeks since we filmed with them, they haven't. So I can't broadcast them. And we're waiting for the time when they can go for us to be able to shed that light on those issues. But life is incredibly difficult for many of these women, and they do feel like the international community, the ones sort of put them on a platform as champions and partners of their war on terror, whatever the slogan they used. Now they feel like they have to fight this fight on their own.
Yelda, thank you. Yelda Hakim, BBC journalist, and also has a foundation, as we said. More details on our website.